You can see here Dr. Paul Offit, and he's the doctor that I mentioned in the beginning, who says that infants can tolerate 100,000 vaccines at once, theoretically, although there's never been any animal model for that. That's his theory. Well, in the context of medical literature, it's astonishing that one of the most well-published vaccine proponents, Paul Offit, and he's a key opinion person who's the go-to soundbite for the American pro-vaccine movement, that he could publish this on his website. He educates doctors worldwide on vaccination. And on his website, from the Children's Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, the Vaccine Education Center, in April of 2013, you could have gone on there and read about your concerns about aluminium in pregnancy, and you could have been totally set at ease by seeing what this website had to say, because this quote was on his website, and it said, "Aluminium is considered to be an essential metal with quantities fluctuating naturally during normal cellular activity. It is found in all tissues and also believed to play an important role in the development of a healthy fetus." Well, I PDF'd that web page in April 2013, and I sent it with a link to one of the world's most knowledgeable aluminium experts, who's usually very diplomatic and polite. And he wrote me back stating something not very flattering about Dr. Paul Offit, which I won't repeat here. But wouldn't you think that a man who considers himself highly educated would have read this following quote that was published in 2011? Dr. Kawahara published a very important article that needs to be read by anybody who has concerns about aluminium. And amongst other things in that article, in the very beginning, he says, "Whilst being environmentally abundant, aluminium is not essential for life. On the contrary, aluminium is a widely recognized neurotoxin that inhibits more than 200 biologically important functions and causes various adverse effects in plants, animals, and humans." He goes into great detail about this. "All the other aluminium researchers I know have no time for Dr. Paul Offit's comments. We need to look at vaccines in pregnancy more closely, starting with aluminium, to see what it really does do in the body." Dr. Kawahara's article is very important because it supports, with 176 medical references, the fact that aluminium is a death factor for cells. He reviews the most state-of-the-art techniques that have brought aluminium back to the forefront of Alzheimer's research and tells why and how the old research that said it wasn't related to Alzheimer's is flawed. This picture denotes some of the problems that he has documented and found himself with the action of aluminium in the body. Now remember, the aluminium is a small radius, very highly positively charged element. So it's going to be attracted to negative charges in the body. Because of that, it's able to travel to places where it really should never go. One of those places is into the brain. And we now know that it does cross the blood-brain barrier. It crosses in cells called macrophages, and there are special transport systems that shuttle it through. We also know that aluminium binds to phosphate in DNA and RNA in the nucleus. Remember all that epigenetic stuff? Well, guess what? When that binds to phosphates in the nucleus, it influences many genes and regulates in abnormal ways gene function. We also know that it binds to ATP. That stands for adenosine triphosphate, which you may have heard of. It's the most important energy molecule in your body, and that's what's used to give, you know, for me to move my muscle right now or for you to run up a hill. That's what you need. Well, aluminium binds to that and influences energy metabolism, and we know that people with aluminium excess end up with very low energy. This also here is an enzyme, and that's calcium or magnesium. And you should know that enzymes are dependent upon certain elements. And in order for them to function properly and have the right conformation, they need these elements. Well, because aluminium is such a highly negatively charged particle, it actually has more of an affinity for those enzymes than the normal elements that are supposed to be working with it. So it comes in, pops calcium and magnesium right off, and takes over and essentially inhibits those enzymes. Without enzymes, your metabolism really can't work very well. In addition to making those enzymes useless, the fact that it's now bound onto them keeps it in the body longer. So this makes the half-life of aluminium even longer. Over here, we see this is an example of a protein. And we know that proteins are supposed to, for the most part, be separate, doing their jobs. And when the aluminium comes along, it cross-links them. It essentially works as a tanning agent because it coagulates proteins in this way. And it causes conformational change. And having the right shape in a protein is really important because the shape often determines its function. So those conformational changes can actually inhibit the degradation of those proteins by their particular proteases. So you can't actually even use them the way your body wants to use them. So aluminium is a huge deal when it comes to proper cell function. So if we go back here, let me just remind you that it's important in the development of a healthy fetus, and quantities fluctuate naturally during normal cellular activity. We really have to scrutinize that. The other thing aluminium does is it damages cell membranes. Remember, I'm going to show you another picture in a minute. Sorry, I got ahead of myself. So this is a cell membrane, a representation of it, phospholipids here. The lipids are in the middle and the phosphos are on the outside. And in the presence of iron, some of these lipid membranes can be damaged. And that's why we have our own antioxidant system. But in the presence of aluminium, these pro-oxidant reactions will happen more. So it's called peroxidation. So it's basically like hydrogen peroxide, which actually can be very toxic to cells. So when aluminium comes in with this iron, it will catalyze using certain enzymes and cause problems in that membrane. And remember what I showed you earlier, that the cell membranes and the environment and what's happening in those membranes has everything to do with how genes function and how the cell functions and how cells talk to each other and whether they grow or whether they die or differentiate and turn into different cells, or whether they turn into cancer. Have a look at this schematic of a cell membrane, which is actually more realistic appearing than the one you saw before. And consider that each of your cells has around 100,000 switches, which have what are called receptors and effectors, meaning it has a signal comes in and then it has an action, okay? Now, that opens and closes to various substances on the outside, and it transmits signals to the inside, telling the nucleus what to do. Then consider the fact that after aluminium exposure, the membranes and the myelin, which is very important for nerve function, become stiff and dysfunctional. Dr. Verstraeten wrote two articles that are really important that detailed in his experimental models showing how the membranes changed in the face of aluminium. And Dr. Kawahara listed several pages of the biological processes that are significantly altered during low levels of aluminium. And he talked about three of them with medical references and how they change the lipid and phospholipids in the body, how they change the physical properties of this membrane, and how they change this membrane fluidity. I think of this as like the kind of car wash that you can go through that has the flaps that go down. And so your proteins are needing to move through this like it's fluid. It's almost like it's a matrix that these proteins can pop up and they can come back down and they can migrate. And it's very important that they're able to move around the way they're supposed to and that this area stays functional. So when you toss aluminium into that, everything changes. The signals that are coming through are altered. Now, this slide looks like a handful, but I'm going to explain everything in it to you. I'm going to explain this slide in detail. So this DAMPS stands for damage-associated molecular patterns. And these are basically things that your cells recognize as alarm signals. And in response to that, they secrete chemicals called cytokines, which recruit other cells which come and clean up the mess and deal with it, okay? And in that process can be very inflammatory. And then the anti-inflammatory side comes down and dampens it down. This is called pathogen-associated molecular patterns, but that's not what I'm going to talk about right now. The aluminium comes in, causes cell damage, secretes all the insides of cells, which alert the immune system, and bring those substances that it came and encountered, including the aluminium and the stuff that leaked out of cells, and brings it to what's called an antigen-presenting cell. That antigen-presenting cell then starts to secrete its own cytokines and will call in T cells. These T cells will then recruit other generations of cells to either inflame, to clean up a mess, because sometimes inflammation is good. It actually helps clean up problems and kill bacteria and dead flesh and remove that dead flesh. And then you need the anti-inflammatory arm to come along and silence that. But what happens with aluminium is that this pro-inflammatory response, which is a Th17, gets set off. This one here, which is a T follicular helper cell system, gets set off. And this one here, the humoral immunity, which is the side that antibodies are secreted and can be associated with allergies, also gets set off. And this is very well documented and established in molecular biology, that this Th2 system is skewed and biased after the exposure to aluminium. And it's actually the basis for why they use it in vaccines. So these infiltrating cells that come in here, these phagocytes here, they will come in and they will have an unlimited diet of aluminium. Now that's different than if you get a cut on your skin that can be dealt with and it's done and over with. These persistent particles continue to stimulate this process and set off an oxidative stress bonfire in the skin, in the system, and causes massive amounts of inflammation. These cells will eat until they die, and then they will release their various substances and continue that process. This is just a better schematic of what happens in the cell. So this is the aluminium adjuvant. That's what it's called, adjuvant, meaning that it helps the vaccine have its inflammatory response. We have cell damage because where that needle goes makes all the difference, and whether there's a needle or not makes all the difference when it comes to aluminium. I'm just going to step aside and just explain this top part for a minute. Because the other thing that we hear on websites like Dr. Paul Offit's is that we shouldn't be worried about aluminium because it's a very abundant metal in the Earth's crust, and we're eating it and drinking it all the time, and it's in our baked goods, and we shouldn't be worried about it. Well, when you eat aluminium, you absorb somewhere between 0.2% and 1.5% of it, okay? When you inject aluminium, you absorb 100% of it. Now, you can inject it in two ways. You can put it directly into a blood vessel, which is how the one study that they used for injection did it, put it right into intravenously. Well, you don't get this happening when you put that into a blood vessel. You don't have that kind of cell damage and all this inflammatory response when you put it into a blood vessel. The trick is to inject it into a muscle, and that's why vaccines are delivered into muscles, because the goal for a vaccine, an injected intramuscular vaccine, is to put this adjuvant in there with a particle of either virus or bacteria and set off an immune reaction that hopefully your cells will remember when they're encountered with that same microbe in the future. So remember that intramuscular is key to causing the damage that I'm talking about here. Now, drinking it is still not a good idea, but you need a lot more of it to become toxic as long as you have normal kidney function. Okay, so this adjuvant is injected, you get the cell damage, and what happens when you get cell damage is that the cells usually will just break open. Those membranes will open and their contents will spill out. Well, it turns out that some of the contents inside of cells are designed to be inflammatory. It's almost like an acid in there, because you want it to be there if you want it to take in a microbe and dissolve it. But what you don't want to happen is for those cells to then break open and cause more inflammation in the body. And that can happen sometimes, which is why we need all those antioxidants in our diet and in our bodies. But normally, that shouldn't be going on and on and on. But what happens here is that the cell breaks open, ATP comes out, DNA comes out, uric acid comes out, these phagolysosomes break open and spill their contents, all highly inflammatory, okay? So then you're calling in more immune cells and more T helper cells to come in and deal with the problem. And they come in and they encounter more aluminum. And it's basically a vicious cycle that continues to go on until the body can finally get on top of it. And in some vaccines, it's actually worse than others. We're finding that in the Gardasil vaccine, this is a big problem, and that these dendritic cells that get activated, sometimes they don't shut off, and this inflammation continues. So the dose of the aluminium, the state, the anti-inflammatory state that it's injected into, and where in the body it's injected is really important. Needle into muscle is what's key. So if anyone wants to argue with you about aluminium, ask them about the different routes of how it can come into the body. Well, it's presumed that aluminium is safe because it's been used in food and vaccines for 70 years, not because it's been tested against placebo and people followed out for long term, but just because it's been done for so long. Because of that, it continues to be added to the vaccine schedule with callous disregard for the many mechanisms of cell injury and the vast medical literature on its toxicity when it's injected, especially. In America, we are giving our babies their first dose of aluminium during pregnancy, and then we're giving them the second one on day one of birth when they get 250 microgram shot. And then just like you do here, we start off with the 1200 microgram doses. That boy that I was presenting today, he got 8 different antigens on one day, 3 times in a row. That was a huge aluminium load that he got. And by the time babies are 18 months old, they're getting around 4,925 micrograms brought into their bodies. Well, there's one really important detail that's almost always left out of the discussion when it comes to aluminium, whether it's injection or ingestion, and that is, what is the kidney function of the person that has taken it in? Well, we know over history that when aluminium is in dialysis fluids, that those patients get really sick, their bones get sick, their brains don't function properly, and it's a big problem. You know, we worked really aggressively to get that aluminium out of the dialysis water before giving dialysis. It's that important if you don't have normal kidney function. Now, if you've got any degree of kidney dysfunction, chances are the aluminium is not going to be excreted as if you have 100% of kidney function. Well, who has low kidney function? It turns out that infants don't have the same percentage when you compare it using the same measurements as adults have. And that premature infants have really low kidney clearance. So, you know, to do these calculations and reassure parents that everything is fine because we've injected aluminium into one adult man intravenously and he got rid of it all, we can't reassure parents about injecting it into their newborns or their babies, because normal kidney function is about 90 mLs per minute per 1.73 meters squared. We have ways of measuring that. And that's just the standard consideration, that greater than 90 is considered normal. Well, when a premature baby is born, it's around 20. And then we can see over here that as time goes on, the average, what we call glomerular filtration rate, or the clearance of substances through the kidney that need filtration, and a 2 to 8 day old average is only around 40. And that it ranges from 17 to 60, so some of them have actually really low clearance, and they never check to see what it is before injecting aluminium in these babies. And you can see that even up to 2 to 12 years, they say, it can only be on a low level, on the low range here, 89, but on average, up to 6 months, most kids don't have their kidney function up to speed. So we have to take this into consideration when doing these analyses, and you very rarely, almost, actually, I've never seen this taken into consideration with an aluminium analysis. There are very few of them out there that have actually injected real babies and looked to see what happened afterwards. But there is one that came out this year by Dr. Mobsis, and what she did was she injected 2-month-old human infants with 3 of the intramuscular, it was one injection, but 3 vaccines, and this is basically just according to the schedule, for a total of 1,200 micrograms of aluminium per the usual infant schedule. With this amounts to about 545 micrograms per kilogram of baby weight. The conclusion of this study, after they measured the urine and blood aluminium levels for 12 hours after they injected it, was that they said that they were reassured to find that there was no significant post-vaccine rise in serum aluminium level after vaccination of preterm infants containing 1,200 micrograms in other literature, and that in their study, they found that there also was no rise in the blood levels and urine levels after injection. So I thought to myself, well, why would you be relieved by that? You've injected aluminium, and you see that it doesn't rise in the blood, and it doesn't rise in the urine. Well, where did it go? And so I wrote to this doctor, and I asked her, and I said, are you aware that the kidney function of these babies is actually really low? And so I'm not surprised to not see a lot of aluminium in the urine. And you didn't find it in the blood, so where else could it have gone? It could only go to organs and to bone. And she wrote me back, and she said, quote, "So we don't really know what happens to the aluminium at this point in time. As you said, more research is needed in this area." Okay? There's something called a minimal risk level that is a theoretical calculation that shouldn't be exceeded according to this theoretical calculation because there could be neurotoxicity. And that's really the problem with aluminium, is that primarily the brain is very sensitive to it and the nervous system is very sensitive to it. Well, this is a really interesting paper because they did these calculations. And if you go and you read the paper, you see that first off, the calculations were based on rodents that were eating aluminium. And the other way they looked at it was that one injection study by Priest that I mentioned already, which looked at one man who got a very small, it was 0.7 micrograms, okay, that's nowhere near what a baby gets, intravenously, and they tagged it with a radio labeled, it was radio labeled aluminium so that they could trace it in his system over time and see where it went. And what they found was that they said it was great because all the aluminium disappeared from the blood after 2 days, and only about 15% of it was taken up into the body and not immediately excreted, but that the aluminium in his body was down to 4% after 1,178 days. So that's about 3 years. And they also used a form of aluminium that's not as toxic as the aluminum hydroxide and aluminum phosphate that's used in vaccines. They use aluminum citrate. His kidneys were also normal. So these are the measurements that they're using for their theoretical calculation, an intravenous dose in one man, a very low dose with normal kidneys, and rats eating aluminium. And based on that, they say that we shouldn't exceed a certain dose of aluminium every day. And then they look at their theoretical ingestion, both in breast milk, and there's low levels of aluminium in breast milk. There's low levels in formula. There's higher levels in vaccines. And so they looked at that and they saw, well, this is what we're calculating as the minimal risk line. And let's see if we add all this together, if it goes higher than that minimal risk line. And conveniently, we see that only spiked through a little bit right there. Well, one of the things with breast milk and formula is that the aluminum in substances that we eat has silicate on it. That's what's in the Earth's crust. It's totally different than this aluminum phosphate and this aluminum hydroxide that we're ingesting, okay? But the other problem with this analysis was that they only looked at hepatitis B and the DTP vaccine. They left out pneumococcal and Hib and hepatitis A, which was another 600 micrograms of aluminium. So even though they found that there were spikes for about 3 days at a time that went through this minimum risk level, they were reassuring that it's probably okay to have these vaccines, and it's not really a big problem in the formula and breast milk, because look, it comes right back down and stays below that line. But what I'm telling you is that these babies don't have kidney function that's as high as that adult man or those rats that were tested, that we're injecting it in a form that they weren't using in those animal studies, and that they didn't look at the whole vaccine schedule. So this essentially is telling you that it can be toxic even with these small amounts of vaccines with this terrible analysis. Dr. Khan and other scientists in 2013 looked at the transport of aluminium into the brain. And after noting that after they did this full analysis, they noted that translocation does happen after intramuscular injections. They specifically looked at intramuscular injections. And then they issued a recommendation about that at the end of their paper. And they said, aluminium has high neurotoxic potential, and planning administration of continuously escalating doses of this poorly biodegradable adjuvant in the population should be carefully evaluated by regulatory agencies, since the compound may be insidiously unsafe. It is likely that good tolerance to aluminium may be challenged by a variety of factors, including over-immunization, blood-brain barrier immaturity, and individual susceptibility factors, and aging, that may be associated with subtle blood-brain barrier alterations and a progressive increase of these special transporters that I mentioned earlier called CCL2. They can be higher in some people, especially as we age, those transporters tend to go up. So the problem with aluminium is that the reason for its use and its efficacy and its toxicity are actually one and the same. The inflammation caused by intramuscular injection adds to the accumulation in lymph nodes, spleen, liver, brain, kidney. Kidney actually is highest, but then when they went and looked, they found that it's even higher deposition in the bone. So all those organs accumulate aluminium in all of us as we grow older. But if we're purposefully injecting it into a muscle and it doesn't have a way to get out very easily, this problem is even bigger. Well, in the 1980s, the amount of aluminium in your vaccine schedule was 1,120 micrograms for the whole schedule. And today, it's 6,150 micrograms. And the year that you did the MenZB vaccine, it was much higher than that, about 5,000 micrograms higher for those vaccines. Those started at 6 weeks of age. Kidney function was not up to 100% at that point. Well, there are more properties of aluminium, but I can't tell you all of them and all the 200 biological processes inhibits, but there are a few more studies that are worth mentioning. There's one that showed that it damaged thymocyte and lymphocyte plasma membranes. So the thymus is really important in training the T cells what to react to and what not to react to. That was Dr. Kamilov, and he said it was at clinically relevant doses, meaning they were not giving mega doses to these animals. It also is known to enhance what's known as excitotoxicity in the brain, which I'll tell you more about that in a minute. These cells, microglia, are really important in the brain. You don't want them to be in a high inflammatory state, but aluminium activates them and inflames them. The literature is just abundant with articles and experiments that show that aluminium interferes with gene expression. It increases vascular endothelial adhesiveness, and Dr. Osterling stated point blank that aluminium is pro-inflammatory and opposes a cardiovascular disease risk. So for the rest of us that are adults and being recommended our aluminium-containing vaccines, we also need to think of this. The Cochrane Collaboration is a global independent network that tries to present evidence-based reviews. Dr. Thomas Jefferson came out with a surprising conclusion on the risk of adverse events after immunization with aluminium-containing DPT vaccines. He said that despite a lack of good quality evidence, we do not recommend that any further research on this topic is undertaken. Put the lid on it. Why? I thought, why on earth? And I kept reading, and the answer became obvious. Assessment of the safety of aluminium in vaccines is important because replacement of aluminium compounds in currently licensed vaccines would necessitate the introduction of a completely new compound that would have to be investigated before licensing. It would also have to be paid for through research and development for all the vaccine companies that would have to get new patents on their vaccines. No obvious candidates to replace aluminium are available. They've tried a few. It didn't go well. So withdrawal for safety reasons would severely affect the immunogenicity and protective effect of some currently licensed vaccines and threaten immunization programs worldwide. In other words, your individual safety is not of primary importance, and we don't need to be doing any research. Close the book. Well, pregnant women in America are recommended to get several aluminium-containing vaccines. All of these except influenza vaccine contains aluminium. And all of these vaccines cause massive inflammation. And during pregnancy, it's really important not to have massive inflammation. I mentioned earlier on that vaccines are recommended in the USA to pregnant women, no matter what the trimester, and that pregnant women are told that they can prevent autism in their unborn children by getting that vaccine and preventing influenza. This idea comes from two flawed ideas. Sorry, this practice comes from two flawed ideas. One is that influenza can cause brain damage in utero. Well, that's true and it's not true. The reason I say it's flawed is because any infection can actually, in a small percentage of fetuses, lead to problems with the brain later. But it has nothing to do with the actual microbe. It has everything to do with maternal immune activation. And again, the medical literature states this over and over and over, that any maternal immune activation, they use viral mimics in order to cause this and show the problem. They inject cytokines to show the problem, meaning that the microbe actually doesn't matter. So to tell a pregnant woman that if they prevent influenza with a flu vaccine is going to prevent autism is just nonsense. The other flawed idea is that pertussis vaccines need to be given to pregnant women so that, and all the family members, so that that newborn does not get pertussis because they could die from it. Well, that's because they think that there's no way to deal with pertussis once it happens, and it's because they think that they have a reliably effective and benign vaccine, and actually none of that is true. And as you now know, aluminium is not safe and it causes massive inflammation. So what does that mean if you gave a pregnant woman a vaccine and activated their cytokines and their inflammatory responses and she can't get it in control of it? That means you've actually have given her an autism vaccine, but not the way that Dr. Poland says it. So the majority of pregnant women will not get the flu, and the minority of their offspring will have problems from it. And the big news is that it actually has nothing to do with the microbe. It's a maternal immune activation. Also, it's important for mothers to know before they're recommended to have these vaccines that effectiveness is actually very low in some years. But worse is that the vaccinated seem to be more prone to non-influenza viral infections, as shown by this paper here. Dr. Cowling published in 2012 and actually used a real placebo, which was saline, which is actually quite rare in vaccine experimentation. They usually use another vaccine, either the previous year's flu shot or a hepatitis A vaccine. And you can imagine that you really can't measure the difference very well when you do that. But this one used an actual saline placebo. And over here, they used the trivalent influenza vaccine. And they tracked to see who got sick and what they got sick with over the year. And they found that the trivalent influenza vaccine recipients had a 5 to 6 times higher rate of non-influenza viral infections. So what does that mean as far as vaccinating family members of pregnant women, vaccinating pregnant women? Well, even if the flu vaccine did work, which according to this, it really didn't have any effect at all, that they can become more susceptible to non-influenza viral infections. So now what are we doing to the fetal brain by exposing it to those cytokines? And some of them are pretty nasty infections. Coxsackie virus and echovirus are no fun. So what happens to a fetal brain when it's stimulated unnecessarily? I mentioned cytokines before. Cytokines are one of the largest and most diverse families of signaling molecules in the body. Under healthy conditions, most cytokines circulate at very low concentrations, but they can actually increase up to 1,000-fold during trauma, stress, and infection. So even a sterile wound can cause an increase in cytokines. A thought can actually increase the cytokines in your body. And these cytokines can be both pro- and anti-inflammatory, though after stress, they're almost always pro-inflammatory, and the anti-inflammatory ones are the ones that can come along and dampen some of that problem. Well, note here in this slide, we have a neuron, consider this a brain cell, and we have these are called microglia and astrocytes, and these are the major brain immune cells, and they are involved in every major aspect of brain development and function, including new synapse formation and trimming back of synapses over and over. And we know that brain pathology is to a very great extent a pathology of these cells here that are supposed to be operating at a low level and not be overstimulated or understimulated. If they're understimulated, you could get meningitis and die. If they're overstimulated, they will cause problems, inflammatory problems with these sensitive cells in the brain. Well, note here the cytokines, inflammatory signals, tumor necrosis factor alpha, interleukin 6 are some of the ones, but interleukin 6 is what I want to call your attention to, because this is a really important cytokine in regulating brain cell excitability. You don't want these brain cells to be hyperexcitable. They find that when autistic children say they die in a car accident, and they've done studies where they actually looked at the brains of autistic children that have died from trauma, and they find that the levels of brain excitability are off the charts, that these cytokines are very high, and that the trimming back process didn't happen properly in their heads. Well, this interleukin 6 actually regulates brain cell excitability, learning, stress responses, feeding, sleep, depressive behaviors in the brain. Do you remember Luke from this morning? Well, he had all of those symptoms once his immune system was deranged and his inflammation was high. And we know his inflammation was high because his C-reactive proteins were off the charts. Yet he was told, his mother was told by the doctor that his screaming and his head hurting had nothing to do with the vaccine and to take some Pamol. Well, cytokine release is similar whether there's infection, whether there's a microbe, whether there's a sterile injury, or whether there's just psychological stress. Dr. Paul Patterson is one of the most famous scientists that are writing about this today, and he has been quoted as saying in his paper in 2009 that microglia can be triggered into a permanently primed or sensitized state by early infection or stress, and this interleukin 6 actually has a lot to do with it. Well, we know of certain microglial triggers. We know that vaccine stimulation in and of itself can trigger microglia, because if you inject a vaccine into a muscle, you're causing all kinds of cytokines, like I showed you earlier, and cytokines in your body actually affect those cells in the brain. So it's not just you have to have the injection into the brain. You can inject it into the body and have inflammation. Think about when you get a flu virus or something like that, and you feel sick and tired and you just want to go to bed. Well, why do you think that is? It's because those cytokines are going into your brain and your sleep center and doing what your brain is designed to do, which is go to sleep and rest when you're sick. It's called sickness behavior. It's well known about. Vaccine components themselves can also stimulate those microglia. The aluminium in there is well known to stimulate them. Any kind of stray DNA, RNA, or protein fragments, which I showed you all the cells that can be used in vaccines, and we know that they're not all filtered out. So that comes along and can stimulate those microglial cells. Mercury, which is still in some of the multi-dose influenza vaccines. And monosodium glutamate makes those brain cells even more sensitive to those cytokines. So they work together, kind of synergistic. Also, because of the importance of the healthy gut microbiome, keeping all that inflammation at a low level, we also know that gut infections and any imbalance in those commensal microbes that lead to inflammation in the body also can lead those cells to be hyperstimulated. We talked a lot about epigenetics and gene regulation, and so you can imagine when genes are upregulated highly, that there's all kinds of opportunity for epigenetic influence. And so this is a time of vulnerability where the brain really needs to be left alone. And this slide was given to me by actually a vaccine immunologist who sent this to us anonymously, showing us developmental periods in the brain. And what you can see here is this is birth, and this is 10 years of age, 3 months, 2 years, 4 years. And you can see this is 100% of gene expression, and this is zero. And you can see that at some point or another, there are several genes that are at 100% of maximum gene expression for these nerve cells in the brain. This one here corresponds to whether a baby is hungry or whether they're full. And you can see it's up at 100% of regulation at birth. And you remember that that baby was pushing its mother away. Something went wrong with its regulation. And there was a problem there. But also, this is really important when it comes to regulating obesity and the baby's drive to feed. And those brain cells actually have a lot to do with that. Then we have the ones that that influence the ability to think. And that's this line here. And we can see that at 3 months, that's maximally upregulated. And there we are throwing immune-stimulating vaccines into that complex, altering the cell membranes in the body, which are sending different signals to those genes in the nucleus. Then we have something called a chandelier neuron, and this has to do with exciting nerves and maintaining muscle tone. And you can see that that one right here is upregulated the same, around 3 months, up to 2 years, and then it starts to fall. So that's when these nerves are multiplying like rapid fire. Then we have a dopamine axon terminal, and that's right here. And this is kind of low at birth, and then it comes up around 2 to 4 years is at its maximum expression. And so this has to do with motivational and reward-related behavior. So these are all things you really want to let go alone when they're supposed to be in their proper timing, functioning, and the genes underlying what they're doing, how they're behaving, whether they're growing, whether they're being trimmed back. You don't want to be causing inflammation around them. Well, brain immune development actually starts very early. It starts in the womb. And I just want to call your attention to these three blocks up here. And that this represents conception. Here we have birth, and then we have 2 years. And there's a little less here at 2 years because most of these developmental windows of immune maturation actually happen in utero. And we can see here that these microglia, these important immune brain cells that need to not be overstimulated, first start to appear at 5.5 weeks in utero. And then we can see that they start to expand into the cerebral wall about 12 to 24 weeks. And then the astrocytes, those other cells that are important in brain regulation of inflammation, appears at 16 weeks and go through to 2 years when these windows of immune maturation. So these are very sensitive times. It's not all just about what happens after the baby is born, but all these influences during gestation can be very either helpful or hindrance. And so think twice about whether you want to inject an inflammatory substance into a pregnant woman, knowing that. I mentioned Dr. Paul Patterson a minute ago. He also wrote a really interesting book called Infectious Behavior, where he talked about the brain immune connections in autism, schizophrenia, and depression. And he has a really big lab, and he has a lot of grant money coming in. He does a lot of experimental work. He's kind of got a foot in both camps, and he doesn't really come out and say much about vaccines except to trash Andrew Wakefield. But one of the things that he says in his book is a commentary on the policy of vaccinating pregnant women. In the beginning, we said you shouldn't vaccinate pregnant women during the first trimester, do it during the third trimester. And then they said, well, you can actually do it in the second or third trimester. And now it's no holds bar. Women can be vaccinated according to policy first, second, or third trimesters. And in response to that, he said, these changes in policy, however, do not appear to have been prompted by truly compelling new evidence regarding the risks or efficacy of the vaccines, because he knows that stimulating that mother's immune system and cytokines can lead to a problem in that fetus, and that actually has nothing to do with the microbe. It has to do with maternal immune activation. So what does the medical literature say about vaccines in pregnant animals? Well, we don't have the human animal model because that's still an experimental one, where if you look on the package inserts or the websites for these vaccines that are recommended in pregnancy, is that they have a registration hotline that you can call and say that you vaccinated a pregnant woman, and they're supposedly keeping tracks. We have only an uncontrolled experimental human model going on right now, but we actually do have some animal models. But before I get to that, I want to direct you to a paper that's free to read online by Dr. Garay. Maternal immune activation may lead to developmental abnormalities in the central nervous system. In the mouse model of pregnancy vaccination, it is the maternal immune response to influenza infection that causes these behavioral abnormalities, not the virus itself. If I'm drumming this point home a lot, it's because it's that important. This is the animal experiment that illustrates what I'm talking about. Dr. Mandel in 2013 took two sets of adult rats and allowed them both to become pregnant, and then vaccinated one group with a viral mimic and vaccinated the other one with just saline. So it wasn't really a vaccine, it was a control. And then they allowed them to have their rat pups, and they waited and vaccinated them at 8 to 10 weeks again, well, after they were born. And then they tracked to see what their immune systems were doing. And what they found was that the pups that were vaccinated while they were in utero and then again later had a much more profoundly exaggerated immune response, and that exaggeration persisted into adulthood. This group over here were vaccinated and had an appropriate immune response. Well, looking a little closer at that, let's look at the cytokines that were upregulated and the difference between those two groups. This one here looked at peritoneal fluid in the vaccinated offspring after they were vaccinated, and looked at the difference between the pups that were born of the vaccinated mother, which are these dark bars, and the ones that were born of the control mothers. And so all these animals were vaccinated after birth, and then they wanted to see what the response was. And they found that these interleukin-6 levels were drastically higher in the ones that were also vaccinated in utero. This is not a proportional line here. You can see that the cytokine level of 1,000, which represents the offspring of the control mothers, and then just a short while higher, were up to 8,000 in the offspring of the vaccinated mothers. So that IL-6 is really important, and it's about 8 times higher in those rats that actually were exposed to a vaccine in utero. So it did have something to do with the programming and the excitability of their immune system. We saw similar patterns for tumor necrosis alpha and interleukin 10. Then they looked at the blood of these animals and they saw a similar thing, similar trend, and that the animals that were vaccinated in utero had markedly higher levels of interleukin 6 in the blood and much lower ones in the ones that did not have the vaccines in utero. And similar trend in interleukin 6. And so it was clear that maternal stimulation during pregnancy altered the development of the innate and adaptive immune systems in the offspring. They took this one step further using a well-characterized encephalitis mouse model. It's an autoimmune encephalitis, and it mimics chronic progressive multiple sclerosis. And this is basically an experiment that's done routinely in labs in order to cause multiple sclerosis. But the purpose of this was to see, well, what would happen, would there be any difference between the two groups? And interestingly enough, what they use is a myelin antigen, and then they put pertussis toxin, which is basically what's in a DPT vaccine, and they wait to see what happens clinically in these mice, whether they become crippled and if they limp and if their tails becomes paralyzed. And then they calculate that they put it into a number and they rate it according to incidence. So now we have how many of these mice that underwent this procedure got sick. And they found there was a huge difference between the mice that were vaccinated in utero and the ones that weren't. The ones that were vaccinated in utero, we have about 45%, and it's denoted by the red arrow there. And the ones that were not vaccinated in utero didn't even show any clinical signs on day one. On day two, a couple of the ones that were not vaccinated started to show clinical symptoms. But what you can see here is that the pathology in the offspring of those vaccinated mothers was earlier, it was more severe, and it was a much higher frequency. The conclusions in this paper were that immune stimulation in the mother led to offspring that had a pro-inflammatory phenotype. Remember, we talked about phenotype. It's basically telling you how the genes act based upon what those cells were exposed to. And that a postnatal immune challenge led to more robust exacerbated immune responses, and that those changes in the immune system persisted into adulthood. It should be clear by now that the developing immune system is highly susceptible to modification, and that disruption by environmental influences, and it is at significantly greater risk than the fully matured immune system of an adult. And that numerous unique immune maturational events are programmed into specific windows of prenatal and neonatal development. And those maturational events are building blocks on which subsequent changes in the immune system are built. In other words, the brain is undergoing lots of changes sequentially, and each of those changes underpins what's going to happen next. And interference in any of these periods, what they call developmental windows, or windows of vulnerability, can be very problematic. So in summary, that these following things can alter the baby's genetic expression. Maternal nutrition deficits. We know that smoking and alcohol, that's well-established epigenetic influence. And that stress and inflammation, no matter where it comes from, can alter the baby's genetic expression, the toddler's genetic expression. That immunization and infection, all the same process, increasing those cytokines and that inflammation can alter the baby's genetic expression and affect the brain. Well, I mentioned that pharmaceutical drugs can have a profound epigenetic effect, and there was a startling paper that I encountered recently, although it was written in 2009, that went through several commonly prescribed drugs and their epigenetic effects. And many of these are actually offered to pregnant women. That includes antacids, painkillers, and antidepressants. They all have epigenetic effects and can all affect the unborn fetus, and also can come through breast milk and have an effect. You know I don't like antibiotics very much. And we know that the microbiome is really, really important and that it needs to not be disturbed. Now, I'm still glad antibiotics were invented because there is a time and a place for them, but I am estimating probably about 2% of what we see used today. And they're just much too overly used and thrown around as if they have no problems at all. And there's a lot of mythology around antibiotics, which is what keeps the prescriptions flowing. And one of them is that once in a while they're harmless, and that's not true. I'll show you why in a minute. That you can control drug resistance by taking the full course. The best way to get drug resistance is actually to stay on an antibiotic for a really long time. And that they completely and accurately kill their targets. First of all, you can't, if you take an antibiotic for something that's living in your bowel, it's not going to kill every one of those microbes that you're targeting. It's going to kill some of those microbes you're targeting and a lot of the other bugs that you're not targeting. And if it seems to work at all, it's only because then your immune system is able to come along and take care of whatever infection is overwhelming you. But they never kill all of the bugs. Your immune system has to eventually do most of the work. The other myth is that it's a playing it safe, that it's a good idea to play it safe and give antibiotics. I see this in newborns all the time and in kids, and just in case, and the prophylactic antibiotics. When there are, you know, reputable medical journals showing that it's actually better to just in case and prophylactically give a probiotic. In 1959, Dr. Rogers compared the infectious landscape in the years just prior to penicillin and then those after. And he stated, quote, "The hope that antimicrobial drugs would abolish infections as a cause of death has not been adequately realized. Infections produced by certain bacteria and fungi are increasing in frequency. Although a reduction in the total number of fatal infections occurred, microbial disease continued to play an impressive part in deaths occurring in a medical unit. Fatal infections observed in 1957 to 1958, that's the post-antibiotic era, were commonly caused by gram-negative bacilli, staphylococci, viruses, and fungi. During this period, fatal infections commonly arose within the hospital in patients already compromised by serious diseases." And we can see that that trend has continued through to today because hospital-acquired infections are a huge problem. And because we know that fungal infections almost never occurred back before the antibiotic era for a couple of reasons. One is that the immunosuppressive drugs weren't as available as they are today. But the other reason was that the human microbiome was very different then than it is today. And the invention of these antibiotics and the rampant use of them when it's not necessary has forever altered the human microbiome. Well, Dr. Rogers wrote in 1959 about how the advent of penicillin and antibiotics did not change the rates of bacterial infections much at all and were associated with an increase in hospital-acquired infections. Dr. Bunn showed that viral infections rose markedly during the golden era of antibiotics. And he said that the newer plagues affecting man and beast are viral and fungal, and the troublesome pestilences are of gram-negative bacterial origins. Well, pneumococci remained in great numbers even then and are still problematic. They've outwitted several generations of antibiotics. They're now outwitting two generations of vaccines. And while these vaccines can very accurately target certain strains of pneumococci, what we find is that the other ones come back, sprout around it, and then we have to expand the number of particular antigens in the vaccine. So just like these bacteria outsmarted the antibiotics, they're also outsmarting vaccines. And today we have scientific information that shows that the use of antibiotics actually decreases your resistance to infection. Dr. Ichinoe showed a key role for the commensal bacteria, those are the good bacteria that should be living in abundance in your colon and your body, is controlling adaptive immunity against respiratory viral infections. And the antibiotic treatment impairs innate immunity signals. The commensal bacteria provide us with essential functions well beyond the digestive system. The use of antibiotics must be curtailed drastically, and doctors must be educated as to nutrition and the scientifically proven use of certain vitamins, minerals, and probiotics. Dr. Wilkes reported similarly, and Dr. Kikuchi also reported on the fact that probiotics are antiviral. So the information is all in the medical literature. It should be simple. So this is just a schematic of what happens when the intestine is napalmed with antibiotics. And what we see on the left is a healthy intestine. And these are potentially pathogenic bacteria, but they're kept out. This is called species competition. And what we see here, these would be the commensal bacteria, the healthy microbes, the bifidobacteria, the lactobacillus. And then we have a mucus layer, another layer of protection. Then we have healthy cells that are kind of joined tightly in the intestinal wall. And then we have macrophages and dendritic cells and the immune system kind of standing guard. And over here, totally different picture after antibiotics have destroyed these protective layers and allowed the pathogens to get closer to the bacterial intestinal cells, cause more inflammation, and deplete the immunity behind there. So it's really important to understand what this slide shows, because 1 week of clindamycin can wipe out an entire genus of microbes and leave only one strain that can be resistant to that antibiotic. And this pattern can persist up to 9 months. And only after 12 months in this experiment did we start to see different microbes coming back. But you can see that even after 2 years, the bacterial diversity did not come back to normal. So there are significant long-term effects, whether you realize it or not. It may not be symptomatic, but that the microbial background after one course of antibiotics changes drastically. And if you're growing clindamycin-resistant bacteria in your bowel after taking an antibiotic, that means you're shedding it. And that means that the people that are living around you can pick that up. And it can be a problem later if their immune system ever crashes and there's no antibiotics to treat it. Well, the major task of the immune system is to know when not to respond, not just knowing when to respond. And that's governed in large part by which bacteria dominate during that colonization process, and that the stepwise introduction of those bacteria takes place at the right times. Our immune system samples the contents of our bowels and has to determine what to respond to and what not to respond to. Whether or not the colonization process happened on time and appropriately can impact allergies, inflammatory bowel diseases, autoimmune diseases, and overall immunity. So not only do antibiotics affect this pattern of colonization, but any kind of repetitive or constant stress or vaccination, the mode of delivery can affect this, and Hillary's going to talk more about that later, and the mode of feeding too. But this is the basic pattern that should be established, is at birth, these two types of bacteria, the bifidobacteria, are really important. They help to, as I said earlier, maintain immune tolerance. And these are basically lactobacillus also, and they come from the mother during a normal vaginal delivery, and then they continue to come from her through breast milk. And then later on, after food is introduced, so it has, a lot of people will talk about this in terms of weaning, but it's not actually the weaning that makes the difference. It's the food, because once that food goes in there, or even infant formula, these microbes change. And then into adulthood, we see that the bifidobacteria still stay up high. They're still really important for us, that these lactobacilli rise and these other bacteria also come up. So knowing what you know now, I ask you to consider if you want to add inflammation to the fetus inside the mother, and consider which interventions actually can cause inflammation. Consider what anti-inflammatory agents really do and whether or not you want to use them, and reconsider any kind of intervention that you would otherwise use if it's an over-the-counter medication or a prescription drug, because they have epigenetic effects, they can alter the microbiome and cause problems, not just in the short term, but in the long term as well.